Hello, listeners. Will you allow me a minute to tell you about Past Test? If you haven't used them yet, you should. They are a fantastic online resource with hundreds of questions and answers covering multiple medical exams, including the MRCS, MRCP, and medical finals. I've used them lots and found the resource so useful, particularly the past papers for these exams. As a listener to the podcast, you lucky people get 15% off some of these subscriptions. So don't wait around. I mean, do until the end of the episode, but then go and get your access. Links and codes will be in the show notes. But before we get going, I'd also like to tell you about a really great resource that I've used for probably all my exams. It's Teach Me Surgery. It's a website covering all the topics you'd need to know. It's really easy to use and clear to follow. It goes through the topics in a logical and comprehensive manner and always finishes making it clinically relevant. Nearly all the content is free, and I'd highly recommend adding it to your regularly used resources. Please find the link in the bio and check it out. Welcome to MRCS on the Move, Bowels, Bones and Backseat Vibers. I'm your host, Naomi, but this is the podcast where you do the talking. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Bowels, Bones and Backseat Vibers. I feel like I say it every week, but it's lovely to be with you, and I mean it. I hope you are all well. I just want to plug for a moment. Please do give me feedback if you have any. I feel like I don't get very much, and I want to make this what you guys find helpful. So please do send your feedback via Instagram, Twitter, however you are able to do it. We are going to jump right back in with Alex, where we stopped before. So continuing with some investigation of lung cancer and the treatment to round the topic off. So enjoy, make the most of a respiratory pro, and yeah, there, here you go. Over, actually, to me, I start the episode. so we mentioned before that you might do a CT tap if you're concerned about metastases. So where do lung cancers most commonly metastasize to?
Yep, so the most common place for metastasized to is within the lung themselves. So you can get lung metastases within the lung, and then you can also get lymph node involvement as well, mediastinal cervical lymphadenopathy. And then in terms of other organ involvement, we think of the most common primary spread sites as the kidney, the prostate in men, the breast, the bones, GI tract, cervix and ovaries, in that sort of order.
Sounds like a lot of places.
A lot of places, yeah. It does tend to be a lot of places that lung cancers can spread to. And as we said, the chance of spread is all dependent on the type of cancer that you see as well.
Yeah. So what investigations would you request, sort of additional, more specific investigations, would you request if the chest CT confirms a likely lung cancer? And these are probably all the things I'm guessing, like MDT and stuff, are going to want to have or request.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Naomi. So
what we
try and do is we try, especially I think most of the lung cancer multidisciplinary teams try and have a lot of the investigations done prior to the patient being brought to MDT, so that when they're presented, they've got a complete picture and you can advise on treatment strategies, whatever that may be. So one thing that, as I said before, is really important before we do any further tests for anyone is to have a look at the patient and see what their performance status is like. We often look at a few things such as performance status, their ACE-27 score and their clinical frailty scale, and also what the patient wants. So if the patient doesn't want any further investigations and they're sadly quite frail, you may not request anything further, and you may say that based on the CT scan, we're going to go for best supportive care here. But
what's the age 27 score?
So age 27 score is a score that I still spend a long time getting my brain around, but it's basically a score from 0 to 3 based on people's comorbidities. And there is a whole list, I'm sure your listeners will be able to look it up and do it better justice than I can trying to describe it, but there's a whole list, it covers a couple of pages, it's by the Royal College of Physicians. So if your listeners search age 27 RCP, they'll come up with this, I think it's a double page spreadsheet. And basically it lists all of their possible comorbidities that a patient could have, and it lists them by our organ systems, and then scores the severity of those illnesses, or the severity of those diseases, from 0 to 3.
Mm.
You then, if a patient scores 3 in any of them, they have an age 27 score of 3. So you take the maximum score that a patient can have, possibly from any organ system disease, and that is their score.
Okay.
And the idea is 0 is better than 3. So the higher your score, the worse your comorbidities are.
Okay.
So these all make up part of the decision process for lung cancer clinicians to decide on how they would go ahead and, what treatment and management plans they would take. But if we assume that we've got someone who's got low performance status and they want all the treatment, things you would next go on to request are things like a PET CT.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we do find that these patients may have already had this done. If the lung cancer clinician's got a high suspicion, we do a PET CT to look for staging, and that's to look for the uptake of the diet around the cancer cells. So that guides us further as to whether a patient may need any other tests, such as endoscopic tests to get biopsy results, or whether there's any distant spread whatsoever, because obviously that will show that there's distant mets. Based on that, we can then book patients for endobronchial ultrasound, transbronchial needle biopsies, and that's where we do an endoscopic ultrasound similar to a bronchoscopy, except that we have a small ultrasound probe on the end of the bronchoscopy probe, and we can then scan from the inside looking for lymph nodes in the bronchial tree, and take biopsies from high uptake lymph nodes.
Mm-hmm.
And we generally should offer that to people who have lymph nodes greater than equal to 10 millimetres in the short axis on CT, and can potentially have treatment with curative intent. And that can give you a relatively minimally invasive histological diagnosis. In terms of other tests that we might do, obviously we've talked about CT scanning and PET scanning people's body, but brain imaging is something that's important to consider. So whether you would do brain imaging or not depends on the stage of a person's lung cancer at presentation. So it's actually not required for patients who have stage 1 disease with no neurological symptoms. There's no indication for brain imaging at all. We do contrast enhanced CTs if a person's got a stage 2 non-small cell lung cancer who's possibly going to have treatment with curative intent, and we then offer them a contrast enhanced MR brain if there's suspicion of lesions, or if anyone with stage 3 and above, we just go straight to contrast enhanced MR brains. And then other things, not necessarily to do with the staging of the cancer itself, but to do with fitness for surgery, are things like pulmonary function tests and echocardiograms to make sure they will be fit for surgical procedures if that was deemed to be appropriate.
Yeah.
Sorry, a bit of a long answer there.
No, thorough. We like a thorough answer. I'm not sure the listeners will be able to say that much in the 10 seconds I give them to answer the question. But, yeah, that's normally the case. So you've mentioned biopsies, and you've probably mentioned a lot of this answer, but what are the biopsy options? And within that, we mentioned taking aspirates. What am I saying? Yeah. So what would you send that fluid, pleural fluid, for?
You're right, we've mentioned a couple of things about biopsying already. So one of the really common ways we do it is this EBUS TBNA or endobronchial sound transbronchial needle aspiration. It's a bit of a mouthful. but basically it's a biopsying paratracheal and peribronchial lymph nodes. And as I said, it's a endoscopic procedure, minimally invasive. We, a lot of patients, we find are very tolerated very well. And relatively low complication rates, especially with an experienced operator. We can also do bronchoscopy. So instead of an EBUS, we can do a standard bronchoscopy, especially useful for people who have central lesions, because you can do things such as sending samples for histology and cytology by doing washes, brushings, or actually biopsying lesions that may be invading the bronchus. So one thing that's really important is that anything we do, we try and get really good sample sizes, because I'm sure it's the same with when you're sampling anything in the surgical world. The better the size of the sample that you send, the more likely you are to get a diagnosis.
I am quite often amazed what they can get from my tiny little bladder biopsies,
though. Yeah, exactly.
It's incredible.
Exactly the same when I send these tiny little worms of samples up that we get in the EBUS, and you get all of this stuff back. The other thing we can do is with peripheral lesions, we can also do with CT guided chest biopsies. And they're often not done by respiratory clinicians. They're done by interventional radiology doctors. So often you find that a lot of the respiratory radiologists do those alongside their reporting work. And as I've said, sometimes, very rarely, we might do fine needle aspiration of lymph nodes if we see that we've got supraclavicular and cervical lymph node involvement. And then if we think that we're struggling with other things, we can sometimes do medical thoracoscopies and pleural biopsies if we think there's been pleural invasion. Often that is the case for people who don't have bronchial carcinoma but have mesotheliomas as well. And if there's diagnostic uncertainty, we may get a sample from there. So I think that answers a bit of the question about biopsies. I can talk a little bit about the pleural fluid as well. So when we do pleural aspirations, we tend to send all samples really for pH, LDH, protein, culture, and then in these cases, more importantly than not, cytology. Again, as with any other biopsy or any other sample that you're sending off for cyto, but more importantly with this, the volume of pleural fluid you send off massively increases your chances of getting a positive cytology. So we tend to send off about 50 milliliters of fluid in a couple of pots to lab. And you may often see that it's bloodstained pleural effusion with cancer, and you would find that the protein is above 30 in most cases, with it being an exudate, and so that's what you tend to see in these people with cancers that's invading the pleura.
Okay, so this is a massive question.
Yeah, I wrote a few notes on this one.
I was just thinking, I always think these podcasts are going to be shorter, but when I give someone who's actually good at the topic the questions, I'm like, oh, they're actually quite a lot of questions. So what are the management options for a lung cancer?
Yeah, so as we mentioned, Naomi, this is quite a long answer, so your listeners are going to have to bear with me, afraid. Like you said before, I don't think they'll be able to do it justice in the 10-second course. Again, before I talk about any of them, it all depends on the patient's fitness for surgery, what type of cancer they've got, what the state of the disease is, and again, what the patient's wishes are. A lot of patients will turn around and say to you, or some patients, as I should say, will turn around to you and say, look, Alex, I don't want any treatment for this. And we just have to make sure that they're making the right decision there, that they're aware of what's going on and the possible treatment options to them. But it's always important to take those things into consideration. So generally when we're talking about treatment, though, we're talking about treating radically, with curative intent. And as we mentioned before, that is generally associated with non-small cell lung cancers. because the small cells are often too locally and too locally advanced and not amenable to treatment. So we often talk about radical treatment, but it's important to mention that there are also palliative and symptomatic treatments that you can do for patients. Often not as important for your listeners maybe to know about, because a lot of the treatments that you guys will be doing as surgeons will be ones that are with radical intent, but we'll talk very briefly around some of those. So most important to your listeners, surgery. So surgery is often the first thing that we try and offer to people if we think it's something that is appropriate. I know, Naomi, you've written a few notes on this as well. You'll probably know a bit more about surgery than I will, but generally, mainly only offer to people who have complete resections, and it's really important to think about whether the patient's actually fit for a surgery or not. So really important to test for things like cardiovascular status. We do something called a shuttle walk, which is testing how their ability to walk, relatively crude test, but a lot of evidence behind it. And then they have to have sufficient lung function to be able to undergo surgery, because creating a RAM, I think you do single lung ventilation for a lot of these people, don't you, during the surgery, and they've got to have a decent FEV1, and I think above 40% predicted.
Yeah.
And we tend to think of people having performance status 0, 1 and 2 as the ones who would be amenable to having cancers. And then important things, really things that go against patients having surgery are things like metastases, especially distant ones, significant nodal involvement and pleural effusions as well. So surgery is obviously one of the things we want to offer to a lot of patients. Radiotherapy is another treatment as well. We talk about radical radiotherapy, so patients can actually have treatment with radiotherapy alone. That tends to be those with localized chest disease, so stage 1 through to 3, and generally those who have performance status of 0 to 1 and either have resectable, surgical, and treatable lung cancer but aren't fit for surgery or don't want surgery, or people have don't have resectable disease but it is within the field of radical radiotherapy without delivering toxic doses. And that comes in the form often a relatively new radiotherapy technique is something called SABR, S-A-B-R, so stereotactic ablative radiotherapy.
Yeah.
So it's very high targeted, high dose radiotherapy for early stage cancers. We tend to aim for 5 centimetres or less, and it's associated with really good outcomes. And it's increasingly being used for people who have early disease but aren't fit for surgery. Sadly, we know that a lot of our cohort people who are quite comorbid and not fit for surgery, but due to new advances in diagnostics, are presenting with early disease, so it's a really good treatment.
Mm.
And then we also talk about palliative radiotherapy. So palliative radiotherapy is used in high doses to shrink tumour sizes and treat complications. So we often think of things like superior carver obstruction. We use high dose radiotherapy to reduce tumour bulk, to reduce the symptoms of SVCO.
Yeah.
And then also, we also use radiotherapy in low doses to control symptoms for people, such as pain control, who have advanced disease. And then one of the newer things that we talk about is immunotherapy, or I probably should call it systemic anti-cancer treatment, which is the correct term for it. So usually we used to talk about chemotherapy being the only systemic anti-cancer treatment, but now we actually send all tumours off to check the tumour genetics and gene expression. So there are a few genes out there, the EFGR gene, ALK, and PD-L1 gene, which I don't think you listeners need to know loads about, but important to know they exist.
Yeah.
But these patients could go for monoclonal antibody treatment, which is really, really effective. Mm. And we often use that in combination with radiotherapy as well.
With a curative intent as well?
Yeah, with curative intent, yeah. Patients who present with these genes have more treatment options available to them.
Do they ever give that like adjuvantly with surgery or anything, would you?
I don't know, actually. I think we do sometimes, but I think what we want to do with some of the surgical candidate is the least amount of time to reduce, so the least amount of complications to reduce their time to surgery. So if someone's fit for surgery, that's what we want to do as soon as we can, because that is the best treatment for those that can receive it.
Okay.
Then I guess important briefly to talk about small cell lung cancer. So it is generally too advanced for surgical treatment, but I think important for your listeners to be aware of is that some very, very rare, very early disease is amenable to surgical treatment. We tend to say to an N0, M0 should be considered, but it's very rare that those patients often present that way. Mostly they're treated with chemotherapy, and it's used for both limited and extensive small cell lung cancer, and that's with the aim of increasing life expectancy. We know that chemotherapy increases life expectancy in those with limited disease by about 15 to 20 months, and those with extensive disease by about 8 to 13 months, so not small figures and important for those people to think about, and that's on average. Obviously some people do present much later and it's not worth it for them. And then radiotherapy, again, we can use for some people, and we know that those with limited disease and PS1 and 0 with those with, we sometimes give those people prophylactic cranial radiotherapy, which improves 3-year survival by about 5%. And so not a small number, but it's something that to put to the patient as to whether they would want that or not.
Yeah. Okay. We are nearly there. So what is VATS, VATS in capital letters?
Yeah, so a VATS is a video-assisted thoracostic surgery. This, like everything else in the surgical world, as you guys will know, is becoming, we're trying to aim for more minimally invasive procedures.
Yeah.
That's exactly what this is. So it's basically, to put it in very layman terms, a keyhole type surgery. So widely used as the standard approach for early stage lung cancer resection.
Yeah.
I know from speaking to you guys that the outcomes are just as good for patients in terms of survival and progression, but comes with shorter bed days, reduced length of stay, reduced pain, reduced complications. So all of those things, especially as the NHS stands at the minute, we know we need to reduce bed days for all sorts of patients, but we know that for surgical outcomes, if we can reduce the amount of time people spend in bed, the better the outcome is with their overall recovery.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm pushing you into the surgical stuff a bit.
That's all right.
So what are the options? Pardon? What was that?
I guess I could pretend to be a surgeon.
Yeah. I never pretend to be a medic, so... So what are the options for thoracic procedures?
So all depends, again, on the type of cancer the person has and where that cancer would present. So we tend to think of the thoracic procedures in terms of what volume of lung we're removing. So we talk about pneumonectomy, so that's removal of entire lung. We tend to do that, that's obviously a more major operation. Those are for the ones that are more advanced cancers or the ones that are centrally located where you cannot remove just a portion of the lung. So there are some risks associated with that. So obviously removing more tissue comes with higher risk. So we talk about bleeding, infections, higher rates of mortality in those patients.
Mm-hmm.
We then think about lobectomies. So there are some additional risks with lobectomies. We just remove a lobe, but with that comes with risk of air leaks and risk of infections as well. There's a slightly increased risk of infection with lobectomies versus pneumonectomies. But generally is preferred if we can do it, because obviously you leave patients with more functioning lung parenchyma afterwards.
Yeah.
And then sometimes we do wedge resections for very small lesions or peripheral lesions that we think we can get away with just getting a good margin around those. I'm saying we here as though I do it, I definitely didn't do it.
The MDT, or the...
The MDT, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I know, Naomi, you put a note here that we've mentioned it before, that all of them use a single lung ventilation, which is why it's really important to know what someone's lung function is beforehand, because if someone's got terrible lung function and struggles to ventilate on both lungs, they're going to really struggle to just the one during the operation. So that plays really into people's decision making when they're going for a workup.
This is all making me think of my grandpa had, I'm going to go with it was non-small cell lung cancer. And had an operation, but he had it out. and is fine now, but he's got really bad COPD, and every time I think about it, I'm like, how? Sort of thing.
Yeah.
The remaining part of your lung must be the good bit, because you had bad COPD before you had your operation. Yeah. But
well, it is amazing though, because we talked, I think we mentioned earlier, we've been for an FEV1 of above 40%, which is still not brilliant. You know, someone's got COPD and their FEV1 is 50%, that's still decent going COPD that they have. So it's amazing what we can do with single lung ventilation, and dual lumen ET tubes and things. So it's quite impressive.
Yeah, I mean, he can't really walk to the local shop at the now, but which is probably his COPD more than anything. But there we go. So last question: what is pleuroedesis?
Yeah, so pleuroedesis is a procedure that we actually do relatively commonly. So it involves adhesion of visceral and costal pleura. So as we mentioned, a lot of these patients might present with pleural invasion, or they may present with a pleural effusion, or we may do something to them to cause a collapse of the lungs, such as a thoracoscopy. So what we try and do is reduce the risk of these complications of lung cancer, such as malignant pleural effusions recurring. Now, what it involves is a steroid, for the most part, it's chemical pleuroedesis in the UK, and it involves a sterile talc powder being mixed up and injected through, often on a respiratory water, a chest tube that's been used to drain the pleural effusion. And the idea is that that's actually a sclerosing agent and causes local irritation of the pleura and causes it to stick back together. It's not got a really high success rate, but it is definitely worth doing. And we know that the more fluid you can drain away from somebody, you hear respiratory clinicians using the crude term drain to dryness. We often try and get as much fluid out as possible, because we know the lower the volume of fluid in the pleural cavity before you do the pleuroedesis, the better chances you've got of achieving good pleuroedesis. So it can also be done after a thoracoscopy, and you often find that that's done. So we do something to cause a pneumothorax to do a thoracoscopy, we will do a pleuroedesis procedure afterwards to try and reduce the risk of further pleural effusions. And sometimes you do see pleuroedesis being used outside of the cancer scenario as well. So for patients who are presenting with recurrent pneumothoraces, we often use it for that as well. A little bit more painful procedure in those patients, because they don't obviously have a fluid area in the pleural space to absorb any of that talc powder that you're putting in, and the irritation can be quite painful for those patients. So for all patients, we do inject lidocaine into the pleural space through the chest tube before we do the pleuroedesis to try and numb the pleura.
Can they have multiple pleuroedesis?
So technically you can, but we tend to say if someone's got had a failed pleuroedesis, especially with a malignant pleural effusion, the chances of that patient then going on to have a successful pleuroedesis are very low. So traditionally we don't try it again.
Okay.
Slightly going off topic, but what we do in those patients is we do an indwelling pleural catheter in a lot of patients.
Okay.
So they go for a tunneled indwelling pleural catheter procedure, which is a permanent chest drain that's tunneled under the skin. And then you can involve district nurses and community palliative care teams for patients to have their pleural effusion drained 2 or 3 times a week to maintain their symptom control in the community. And sometimes we do that if we think patients have got a relatively longer life expectancy. We may try and put IPC in to give them a chance of decent symptom control in the community and reduce the risk of admission to hospital in patients with terminal disease.
Yeah. Okay. I think we're done.
Hopefully it was useful. I didn't just drone on to your listeners. I didn't fall asleep listening to my management of lung cancer.
I hope not. They're meant to be driving, so...
I really hope they didn't fall asleep.
Yeah.
The voice of a car accident.
I guess we'll never know, but Anyway, thank you very much, Alex. It was so great to have you on. That was really useful. I learned some stuff. And I'll see you next week for sodium, yeah?
Yeah, brilliant.
Okay, thank you.
Very brief podcast. What's the fluid status?
Yeah, exactly. Go away and find out what the fluid status is. That's what it'll be. Great. Well, thank you very much. And listeners, great to be with you again. And keep on revising. Bye-bye. Oh, well, a dim-bone, dim-bone, dim-try-bone.